Well, let the good times roll. And speaking of good times, I guess it's a very good time to welcome our guest, Janet Smith Warfield, who is calling us indeed from somewhere in the great, wide, wonderful universe. I do believe it is somewhere in America. Janet, how are you?
I am doing just fine, Alan. How are you?
I'm great. Where exactly are you?
At the moment, I'm in Phoenix. I was in Cleveland last weekend, and before that, I was in St. Mary's, Georgia. And before that, I came up from Panama.
Wow. I know. We've Skyped each other from Panama. That's the last visible sighting of Janet Smith Warfield that I've had. But indeed, you've been on the road with your new book, and we're going to talk about your new book, Shift, and find out a little bit more about your incredible journey. I think I've pretty much articulated in my emails to people about the show tonight that indeed Janet had an experience about 35 years ago that we want to talk to her about. It was an unexpected mystical experience, and she's going to describe it to us in a little more detail. I will tell you this, that her book, Shift, which I have a copy of sitting in front of me, Change Your Words, Change Your World, has become an Amazon bestseller, and it was winner in 2008 of the Next Generation Indie Book Award for Best New Age Nonfiction. Is this your first book, Janet?
It's my first full book. I have done smaller chapbooks of poetry, and I've done a tips booklet.
Well, it reads wonderfully well, I must tell you, and particularly at the end of each chapter, there's quite an there's some inspirational words, and after all, words sort of compose a lot about so the book is a compilation of words, as is any book, but you as an author have articulated it in a particular way to reflect how indeed when you change your words, you change your world. Tell us how you came up with that title.
That was a challenge. Shift was not the challenge. I knew that needed to be the title because what you're dealing with in a mystical experience is a sudden consciousness shift. It's just like looking at an optical illusion. What is out there doesn't change, but your mind takes what is out there and shapes it one way or another, so that the entire book is based on this whole idea of consciousness shifts, and you can bring about consciousness shifts by word shifts, emotion shifts, action shifts. They all work together. I put the book together the way I did. I spent 35 years, actually, trying to figure out how to communicate this. I can't communicate it, but often I find I can catalyze a similar aha experience in other people by using words in different kinds of ways that people don't expect, so they have to stop for a minute and think, wonder what she means by that, or I never thought about it that way. Maybe I'll try that. And what I'm finding is happening is that people who get something out of the book and are willing to change their conditioned behavior and then just notice what happens, sometimes have amazing results.
So interesting, I just opened the book and just the first chapter, I just opened it to this. I didn't plan on this. I just opened the book to chapter 29, Living in the Present Moment, the time is now. And, of course, we've shared inspirational words from the Buddha, and this one here is particularly interesting. The secret of health for both mind and body is not to mourn for the past, not to worry about the future, or not to anticipate troubles, but to live the present moment wisely and earnestly. Now, there's someone from Vancouver who shares the same message, and of course, he's become a bestseller and he's been put under the wing of Oprah and risen to quite the heights. And then, of course, that's Eckhart Tolle and his book, The Power of Now. So your chapter 29 is focuses on that, doesn't it?
The present moment is really all any of us has. We can spend the present moment thinking about the future or thinking about the past, but that does not help us deal with our current situation right here and now. It's also a lot less stressful when you keep your mind in the present moment because you're not dragged down by guilt for things you've done in the past. You're not worrying with fear for things that might happen in the future. You are just keeping your mind and your awareness right here, right now, and taking the next step, whatever that is for you. It's truly the only way to live.
Well, there is only now, and of course, just a moment ago was gone. Can't be retrieved, and we can't predict the future. What do you tell people who are listening to the show today, particularly those who are in a great deal of turmoil with their lives due to the, or probably ever since the financial meltdown? I don't know what kind of energy you're picking up in Phoenix. That was probably the one city that probably suffered the most in terms of foreclosures and sort of the destruction of the American dream, if indeed there ever was one. I remember when I interviewed people for my book, I would ask them, so tell me, what is the American dream? And they had a great deal of difficulty answering, except to say, well, it's getting a house, and it's getting the two-car garage, and the house in the suburbs, the great job, and all of this sort of thing, all these material things. And then I would say, well, can't you get that somewhere else? I mean, surely to God, you can get a house in the Netherlands or Canada. And they say, well, no, I don't think so. You can only get it in America. And I think that's a real belief. And for those people who have suffered loss and have lost their homes, you know, they've gone into deep depression. They've become suicidal. It's almost as if by losing the American dream, somehow in their mind they perceive that they failed. How do you reach out to those people? And what energy are you picking up in Phoenix there?
I haven't really noticed that kind of energy in Phoenix, but for someone who is stuck in that kind of energy, first of all, I'd suggest to them start caring for yourself, start loving yourself, take the next step, whatever that is for you, let go of your fear if you can. And a good way to do that is just, again, bring your mind back to the present moment. Get it out of the future or get it out of the past. You are not a failure. You've been perhaps in a situation which is very painful for you. But just notice what's going on in your body. Decide whether you want to hold on to that or whether you want to let it go. And if you want to let it go, consider doing things like, for example, a vision board, where you just sit down with a pile of magazines. You cut out the things that appeal to you at the moment. Sometimes this kind of crisis is exactly what we need to move in a different direction, which is going to be much more beneficial for us. It's never fun when we're down in the dumps and we're going through a crisis. And I've been through quite a few of them in my own life. But I know I have gained strength from them. I've gained skills. I've moved in an entirely different direction. I went through a divorce when I was about age 40. Very, very difficult. Had virtually no money. Went back into the job market at $1.50 an hour. It was just taking that next step. The next step for me was to apply to law school. And I was accepted, went through, and practiced law for 22 years. I never would have done that had I stayed in that marriage. So that as bad as it feels when you're going through some kind of crisis, there's always an upside on the other side. And if you're down real low, the only way you can go is up. The way what you focus on, the way you choose your words and choose your thoughts is going to change the whole energy you feel. Look for the good things in your life. What do you have to be grateful for? People tell you you ought to be grateful. There's nothing you ought to do, but you would be really surprised what a shift it will make in your energy if you just think of all the good things in your life, whether it's your children, your wife, the fact that you do have a roof over your head. You're not sleeping in the mud like the soldiers in Afghanistan. You do have food to eat and water to drink. You have clothes on your back. There's so much that we can be thankful for. Even a gorgeous sunset or sunrise or a beautiful walk in the woods.
It almost seems as though when we were younger, I remember as a child, those little things were part of our daily life because we didn't have computers, we didn't have television when I was really young. So really, we, as children, we played with other children, or we were by ourselves, we were outside, and I remember just enjoying the weather. If it was hot or if it was cold, you experienced everything. And for some reason, we moved away from that, from those feelings, and we turned everything over to, you know, we then began to become affected by what we saw on television, what we read in the newspaper, now what we see on computers. It's like the noise is now in our face. And the only way people can really appreciate what they truly have or their surroundings is to go on a so-called retreat or to go away for the weekend. We never went away anywhere for the weekend. We stayed as a family and had dinner together and had our relatives over. And we never went anywhere. It was a big deal to go somewhere like on a trip, but we certainly didn't have retreats in those days. Do you think that over time we've kind of turned our feelings over to someone else to dictate how we're going to feel?
I think that that's a huge challenge right now in society. And when you're focused on what somebody else is thinking, saying, or doing, you're giving your power away to someone else. I'm thinking even in our suburban neighborhoods these days, just to go out for a walk in the morning, notice the flowers. When you're walking, you see things that you don't see when you're riding. Look at the sky. Look at the cloud patterns. Get back in touch with whatever aspect of nature is important to you. Yeah, turn off the TV. You don't need a lot of scary, negative stuff coming into your head. It's not going to help you. What's going to help you is getting back in touch with yourself, with who you are, with your own feelings, and with the people who surround you. Just to frequently to reach out a hand to help someone else when you can easily do it, or if you need help, ask for help. Make sure you ask the right people. That's all. You have to be selective in the people that you ask for help.
Our guest tonight in the living room late night is Janet Smith Warfield, and when we come back after the break, we're going to ask her the question that I led off the show with: what exactly happened to her 35 years ago? So we'll come back and rejoin Janet Smith Warfield right after we hear a little bit from Diana Krall.
And while we still have chest. Let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune. And while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
Do that. All of us can do exactly what you did, Alan, which is just look at the things in life that make us happy and get involved in as many of them as you possibly can.
Yeah, I think there's a real need for that. Speaking of childhood, there's a on page 101, I think, of your book here, you said, think about your childhood. Was it a a pleasant time of your life, or was it so filled with terror that you resist thinking about it? Perhaps you lived a childhood full of anger and fear. If you find yourself resisting going back to fearful moments of your childhood, trust that you will only go as deeply into these experiences as you are ready to go. Know also that until you are willing to go to the depths of your fear, you will never experience peace, courage, and self-mastery. Is that your story as well, Janet?
Oh, I think it definitely is. I've been at times in my life in the depths of despair, but I simply wasn't ready to roll over and die yet. I wanted to go on living, so I picked myself up and I went on. It hasn't been easy for me lots of times, but it's been very strengthening, and it's helped me clarify for myself what really matters in life to me. The big house, yeah, maybe it's nice, but then there's a lot to take care of. The fancy car, frankly, who cares? What matters to me is really warm, supportive friendships and relationships. I am so grateful for the people I have in my life who love me, support me, help lift me up when I'm down, extend a loving hand and say, come on, let's go, you can do it. Those are the people I want to surround myself with, and it's the kind of person I try to be at this point. So I think going to the depths of despair and then coming back up out of it, you realize you don't want to be there again. So you make different choices in your life so that you don't have to experience all that pain again. It's a learning experience like anything else.
Yeah, it's that humbling experience that that finally rids us of the ego, which really carries us through for a number of years. Let's talk about what happened to you 35 years ago. When you talk about this unexpected mystical experience, can you tell us what happened?
Could I talk first about an experience that happened before the mystical experience?
Sure.
Because that is really what led into the mystical experience. I had three little boys. They were all preschoolers. And when my youngest son was born, my oldest child, who was about five at the time, began wetting the bed. Well, I was extremely frustrated. I was horribly busy as a young mother with three little preschoolers and taking care of a house and a family and a husband. So having a wet bed, wet sheets to change every morning didn't please me a heck of a lot. At first, I ignored it. I figured maybe it would go away on its own. It didn't. And then I pulled my oldest son aside, and I explained to him why he was too old to wet the bed. The bed was still wet the next morning. I began raising my voice with him. The bed was still wet. I spanked him once. The bed was still wet. And I was totally at my wit's end. I had tried every disciplinary or persuasive technique I knew to get this child to stop wetting the bed, and nothing worked. At that point, my mother gave me a book called Summerhill by an English schoolmaster named A.S. Neal. Now, Neal did some very strange things with the children in his boarding school. He had a lot of behavior problems there. But when a child misbehaved, Neal gave that child a penny. Well, I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, this doesn't make any sense to me. But as I say, I was desperate. When Neal did that, he wasn't moralistic about it. It was just the child was running around, jumping, screaming. I gave him a penny, and he stopped doing it. I thought, that's interesting. I'm going to try this with my oldest son. Well, the next morning, I got up. His bed was wet. I didn't say a word, and I didn't at all understand what I was doing, but I didn't say a word. I went to my wallet. I got a penny. I gave it to him, and I walked away. He looked at me as if I was really nuts, like, what's wrong with her? She's not hollering at me. But he never wet the bed again. That blew my mind. And I didn't understand it. But I was just following what someone else had done. I was following a model that had been presented to me. And it started me thinking along a whole different line. The actual mystical experience, I started using this technique in lots of different situations. I mean, there were a couple of Bill's friends were out in the backyard about ready to throw punches at each other. And maybe before I would have given them a lecture on why they shouldn't fight, I didn't do that. I just pulled each one aside separately and I said to each one of them, do you want to fight? They both said the same thing. No, I don't want to fight. He's making me do it. And I said, well, if you want to fight, go ahead. And they kind of looked at each other, and they looked down at the ground, and they mumbled a little bit. And 2 minutes later, they were playing happily together. And I thought, wow, you know, this is an amazing technique that's solving a lot of problems. The mystical experience itself, again, I'm playing with all this stuff and just watching what happens. A man came to my door. I think he was a neighbor, but not a close neighbor. I don't remember who he was, what he wore. I really don't remember anything about him except that he was extremely angry and he was angry with me. I don't even remember why. All I remember was this huge anger. And in the past, I probably would have gotten defensive or explained to him why I'd done what I'd done or why he shouldn't be angry. I didn't do any of that. I just said, you know, I'm really sorry. What can I do to make this better? And just like that, the anger stopped. And when he left, we were friends. And it was at that point I remembered words I'd learned in Sunday school as a child. Resist not evil, but turn the other cheek. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is what those words mean. Now, before, they'd always seemed really strange to me. You know, why, if somebody hits me on one cheek, should I turn the other cheek and let him hit me again? Didn't make any sense to me. And it always seemed as if it was an instruction to deny my own needs to satisfy somebody else. It isn't that at all, because what I did with a man at the door was very self-serving. I wanted his anger to stop. I got it to stop by asking him what I could do to help. So it just gave me a totally different understanding of those words that I'd learned as a child in Sunday school. It wasn't denying myself to please somebody else, and it wasn't doing some really stupid thing. It was a very self-serving and other serving action. I felt ecstatic. I felt, oh my gosh, now I understand, I know, and I immediately wanted to tell everybody else about it and discovered as I tried to talk about it that nobody understood what I was saying. That then led to years and years of working with words, getting clearer myself about meanings and my own values, building a lot of courage and strength as I had more challenges to overcome. Going to law school, which the spiritual reason for going to law school was to learn to use words as clearly as possible so that I could communicate this experience. It's been a lifelong mission for me to figure out how to get what I understand and know over to other people so that they can use it as well and improve their lives in many, many, many ways.
So
I've learned. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say that I think what you're telling us is that you know, it's all about the journey, and that, you know, the old expression, if you want to make God laugh, tell him you have a plan.
So, yeah.
You know, like who would have believed that here you are today in Phoenix, Arizona, talking about a book, Shift, like in your wildest imagination, when you were sitting in law school, would you have ever expected to be doing this? You would have probably, just as all of us have said, you know, wherever we were at that time in our life, that was it. That's all we knew. And so it's like never questioning the doors that are being shut, never questioning the loss of, you know, a divorce or the loss of a job, or, you know, everybody says, you know, when one door closes, another one opens. Well, that's, in a very literal sense, if you magnify that like 100-fold, it really is true. It's like you never know what's going to be expected of you. I've always been in service, it seems, since I was a child. I remember my father, you know, scolding me because I'd run off to volunteer somewhere instead of going to get a job or something, or working, you know, I felt this burning desire to always be in service. So my whole life has been, whether it's with Big Brothers or organizations that I worked for, being in service to people. And it just came so naturally to me. And I think that for a lot of people, they shove that natural tendency down and do something else. And they think, no, I can't. I really can't do it intuitively. I should be doing. I feel like I should be doing something else. So I'm just, you know, it's the journey that's intriguing, isn't it?
The journey is fascinating, and the journey certainly has taken me down into a lot of very deep valleys and up to a lot of very high mountains. It is interesting to me, as you say, there are a lot of things in my life that I never, at age 20, for example, would have thought that I would ever do. I never planned to be a lawyer, but it's something that came into my life through necessity, and it's given me a lot of skills and strengths, and it has fit in with my spiritual purpose for being on this planet. And that I have known for a long, long time. As far as actually implementing it, that has been a long, long journey, and that is still in a work in progress, and it will be until the day that my body dies.
Janet, we've got some people that are going to want to call in and ask some questions, and we've also got some emails coming in, and we're going to respond to all of that. Here's our call-in number for those of you who would like to have a question for Janet. It's, don't forget the 1-646-716-4604. That's 646-716-4604. Come to the website, join us in the chat room. If you've got an email, send that to me, and we will answer all of those questions when we come back after this break.
If I should write a book for you, that brought me and fortune too, that book would be like my heart and me, dedicated to you. Thank you. that brought me fame and fortune too. That book would be like my heart and me, dedicated to you. If I should paint a picture too that showed the loveliness of you, my art would be like my heart and me, dedicated to you. Lights up my way to you, because with you I know a lifetime could be just one heavenly day. If I should find a twinkling star, one half so wondrous as you are, that star would be like my heart and me, dedicated to you.
Everybody who has ever touched my life, including people who at the time I thought were pretty ugly and nasty, because they have helped me move forward. They have actually given me gifts of courage, strength, focus, developing my skills. They've pushed me to become better all the time. So yes, everyone who has ever touched my life, even though it didn't feel good at the time sometimes.
Yeah. Well, we have a question here from John from San Diego, emailing us a question. When I was 10 years old, I loved to paint, but my father told me there was no money in it, so I became an engineer. I'm still an engineer and haven't picked up a paintbrush since. Do you have any suggestions?
Yes. Do you still want to paint? If you do, go out to the art store, get yourself some supplies, set aside a block of time, and start doing it. Do you love engineering? If you don't, and I know we all need to find a source of money to take care of our basic needs, but if you don't really love engineering, consider shifting your life to something that you truly do love. And then ask for support and help from the universe and stay open to what appears, what comes into your life to give you that help and support.
It must be a real shame for John. I know you're listening. It's probably uncomfortable for you to come on the air, but I feel for you because it's, that's a tough one. He was 10 years old, and his father implanted that in his brain that, even though he may have been a great painter with great potential, and yet one of the parents is saying, you know, kind of discouraging, not just discouraging him from doing it, but denying him that pleasure in his life. And here he is, an engineer, and you're right, he may not be happy being an engineer, but he feels like he has to because he has to have a job. So, you know, the choice for people is, do you want to have a job that you don't like and deny yourself the opportunity to be happy? So you're suffering from all that stress and who knows what else.
And it's all a matter of choice. And maybe there would be a way here for John to, and I'm making assumptions here, maybe he loves to do engineering. If he does, that's wonderful. But if he doesn't and he thinks he would love to do art, well, doggone it, go out to the art supply store, get yourself some supplies, look for a local community college that might have some art classes if you want to do that. Start spending time with other people who are interested in art, because you will support one another in your interest and also perhaps in your ability to make some money by doing your artwork. That's the ideal situation,
yeah.
If you can make money by doing what you love.
Yeah, well, we've got a few minutes left here, but I recall, you know, the great Tony Bennett, and you know, I think the reason he's still surviving at 83 or 84, whatever he is that he is absolutely passionate about singing and loves to sing, but he is equally passionate about painting. And he's got the two loves of his life right there. So when he's not singing, he's painting. And he's always got a smile on his face. So there's something about doing what you love and you're passionate about. So tell us, Jana, just in a couple of minutes we've got left here now, where people can get your book and also where they might be able to see you on a book signing or something, and then your website.
Okay, my website is Word Sculptures, WordSculptures.com, and you can buy my book there. You can buy it on Amazon. It is in actually a number of libraries throughout the United States and Canada. You can check with your local library, see if they have it. I also have a blog at janetsmithwarfield.com. What else did you ask me, Alan? There was
where are you heading off on your tour next? Where can people see you in person?
Well, this morning I did a recorded TV interview, which will air on the internet. I'm not quite sure when, probably within the next 3 or 4 weeks. That is the author's show with Linda Thompson. So there will be a TV spot. Sunday I'm flying to Santa Fe, and on Monday I'm doing a 2-hour presentation in Santa Fe at a bookstore there, and I don't have the name right in front of me. But
that's okay. Well, listen, I'll tell you what, people can go to your website, get all that information, go to Amazon, buy her book. It's worth it. Thank you so much, Jana, for being on the show tonight. We've got to dash off. All the best to you. May the Zen be with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and I loved your music.
All right. Thank you. Bye for now.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye,
Janice. Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, there's Janice Smith-Warfield, and we're going to exit stage right with Little Art Blakey, and we'll see you all next week once again for Late Night Conversations. And stay tuned, and we'll let you know who's going to be on the show with our usual email. And check out our website, www.zenbiz.net. That's ZENBIZ.net or ZENBIZ.net. Have a great evening. Sleep tight.